Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots to come this hour in our quick conversations about news we may have talked about a little bit this week. We'll talk about next week in one case. Later in the hour, once upon a time in the state, it was debated whether basketball was healthy and appropriate for girls. Well, now the Iowa State Girls Basketball Tournament is turning 100. We'll talk about that later in the program. Also, in just a few minutes, I'll talk with Katie Pikus, our Western Iowa reporter, about the news this week that the Catholic Church Diocese of Sioux City has made public a list of priests who sexually abused minors. Lots to come this hour. Let's start off with Kay Henderson. Kay Henderson, a Radio Iowa news director, to look at what is headed this way or what happened in terms of legislation this week at the Iowa legislature. Kay Henderson, welcome to the program.
Lots going on up at the Capitol this week.
That's right, and we have to keep in mind that the first funnel at the State House is just a week away.
Correct.
That funnel is the first deadline to pass legislation out of committees, right? A short way to say that.
Correct.
Okay, so let's talk about a number of issues. Birth control, there's a proposal, the governor's behind it, that would expand access to birth control in Iowa. Tell us about that.
It's advanced to the committee level in the Iowa Senate. It's being championed in the Senate by Senator Marionette Miller Meeks. People may remember that she used to be the head of the Iowa Department of Public Health. She was appointed to that position by former Governor Terry Branstad. She has run for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District several times, and she is an advocate of this change. As is, by the way, Senator Joni Ernst. She has talked about doing this at the national level. Governor Reynolds began talking about this in the fall in advance of the election, about giving Iowa women greater access to various forms of birth control through their pharmacy. And what has emerged is a proposal that's very similar to a law in the state of Utah. There have been some opponents who have raised concerns, suggesting that it's necessary for women to go and consult with a doctor, because the doctor can determine, for instance, if you're part of a family who has a history of breast cancer, you'll want to take a different level of a birth control. But others say women are perfectly capable of analyzing their options and making a trip to the pharmacy, filling out some paperwork, and essentially getting their birth control from the pharmacist.
Kay Henderson, let me ask you a couple of public school-related items in the legislature. A dispute over how long an Iowa high school student may be suspended from extracurricular activities. This is for academic reasons. What's the controversy here?
The controversy, apparently, in a few and perhaps several instances, is that students who haven't made the grade have been forced to sit out from athletic competition for essentially a month, 30 days, mm-hmm. and then following that 30-day period have been asked to sit out from another extracurricular, say drama or speech. And a state senator named Jake Chapman has sponsored legislation that asked the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union and the Iowa High School Athletic Association that manages boys' sports in the state to sit down and come up with a uniform statewide policy. The school administrators of Iowa that represent the superintendents and principals of the state are objecting to this. They say this is a local decision that should be made by local school boards and local administrators.
Mm-hmm. Also in the school sector, up to the Iowa schools are required to have a nurse, also a librarian, a teacher librarian here. Now there's a move to get rid of that mandate?
There was. It was a bill sponsored by Senator Amy Sinclair. It includes a number of different items, including the two that you just mentioned. There was a subcommittee hearing at which representatives advocated for keeping school nurses particularly in an era where many children have prescription medications, or perhaps they are epileptics. Many administrators thought it would open schools up to liability were there not a professional, a nurse, on school grounds to help navigate those particular issues. Mm-hmm. Teacher librarians were in the room as well, making the case that they help students, particularly in an era where it's hard to navigate the digital world, determine what is real and what is a valuable research source. As you know, they march out of school, they want them equipped with those sort of critical thinking skills.
Mm-hmm. Is this move still alive? Does it have support?
It came up in the Senate Education Committee, and those two provisions were removed from the bill. So at this point, student teacher librarians and school nurses seem to be breathing a sigh of relief. One thing that the bill does do is it changes the reporting for certain health measures that schools keep track of among their student body and then report to the Department of Public Health. These are things like, has the student been tested for lead poisoning and a couple of other health measures.
Mm-hmm. A resolution proposing a constitutional amendment, this to automatically restore voting rights to felons. These are felons who've completed their sentences. It's moved ahead this week as well, right?
It has, and it was a very interesting hearing at the State House. There were two folks who told senators their own personal stories about being a felon and about the value of becoming part of the community. You also heard people ranging from conservative groups to more liberal groups expressing support for this, and there were a couple of pastors in the room who told legislators, this is about redemption, this is about second chances. Governor Reynolds amplified that during her weekly news conference when she discussed the reasons why she was seeking this change and recommending that legislators sort of set the wheels in motion for this constitutional amendment. A constitutional amendment, as you've often talked about on this program, is a difficult process to get through. This proposal has to clear the Iowa legislature in 2019 or 2020, and then again in the same form in 2021 or 22, and November of 22 is the earliest that Iowa voters might be casting their opinions on this.
Mm-hmm. Also, a bill that pops up every few years, it seems, but since the 1960s, we've not had a death penalty in
right.
Iowa. It emerged in the legislature this week.
It did. It has 20 co-sponsors in the Iowa Senate. Mentioning what the governor talked about during her weekly news conference, she said it didn't seem to her that the status of this had changed much since last year. People may recall that a Republican in the Iowa House, Stephen Holt, who's now the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, said he supports the concept of capital punishment, but when he did the research, he determined that it was less expensive to put someone in prison for life on a first-degree murder conviction as opposed to putting them on death row and having the state pay the tab for years of court challenges of that death sentence. There was a subcommittee in the Iowa Senate that discussed this issue, but again, it only has 20 co-sponsors, Republicans in the Senate, and it takes 26 yes votes for a bill to clear the Senate. So it doesn't appear that this is something that's going to be passing the Senate this year.
Kay, before we say goodbye, please touch briefly on the plan for a children's mental health system that matches what we have available for adults here in the state.
Exactly. The governor has made this a priority. A plan has started to be reviewed by legislators. Advocates worry that there is not a long-term source of funding outlined in this plan. Others say there should be some sort of clearinghouse, maybe a hotline that parents and people who are suffering from mental illness can call and get recommendations of where they can go to get help. That's very difficult for parents who have a child who's suffering from some sort of mental illness. They just have a hard time finding the proper care.
Okay, Kay Henderson, keeping us up to date on a half dozen, a handful of items at the Iowa legislature. Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks, Kay.
Thanks for the invitation.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this week, you probably heard the news, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Sioux City made public a list of 28 priests credibly accused of sexually abusing minors. Iowa Public Radio's Katie Pikus has been covering this story. She joins me now. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Ben.
So what's happened in the Sioux City area this week?
Yeah, so as you said, the diocese published this list this week. They want the 100 or so victims who have been abused by these priests to know that they truly believe them. And they said, you know, this will start a new era of accountability. They held a press conference in Sioux City on Monday where Bishop Walker Nicholas said he wants the victims to know that the diocese truly believes them. And I have some audio from him, so let's listen.
Only trained investigators can actually tell, you know, what is a credible case, what is not. And we know, you know.
Publishing this list is the beginning, I hope, of a new chapter in the history of our diocese. We want to usher in a climate of openness and transparency, resulting in the protection of our youth and accountability for clergy and church leaders. As leaders in faith, we must do everything we can to atone and help remedy our church's sins. But we also are committed to minimizing the chances of this happening again.
Katie Pikus, tell us a little bit more about what we know about these priests. These are cases of credible accusations of sexual abuse against minors going way back to 1948. Did I see that year?
Yeah, 1948 was the very first known case. We know the priest's name. We know their year of ordination, you know, what assignments they had on the list that the diocese gave us and that they published online. You can also see how many allegations they each have against them, or at least how many credible accusations, meaning that there was some sort of proof or corroboration. We can also even see what gender the victims are, you know, the approximate date of the abuse, whether these priests are alive or dead. And the biggest trend in this list that I noticed is that 14 of these priests only have one credible allegation against them, and that's half of the people on the list.
Hmm. What is the statute of limitations on such crimes?
The statute of limitations for these crimes is 10 years, you know, 10 years after the victim turns 18. And, you know, there actually is a bill in the State House right now to remove that time limit.
All right. And we'll be talking about that in depth on this program Monday. You know, what has been the reaction there in the Sioux City area to this announcement?
As for, you know, the people in the church itself, they had a mass of renewal on Thursday. So I think that the general consensus of the people in Sioux City is that, you know, it's about time that this list has come out and that the diocese has taken a very, very big step.
Mm-hmm. And you also talked to a group that represents survivors of those abused by priests. What did you find out there?
I did. I reached out to the Survivors Network of those abused by priests, and they're a large support network. Zach Heiner, the executive director, says, you know, again, this is a huge step forward. It's a huge step towards transparency. He said, you know, the list shows survivors that they're not alone, and it may even help others come forward. However, there is some concern he has over this phrase, credibly accused, because there's a review board within the diocese that investigates these cases independently to determine if they're credible. And as I had said before, you know, there has to be a good deal of evidence, physical evidence, witness testimonies, corroboration. And Heiner even said, you know, they've had survivors come forward when these lists come out that they hear from, and they say, wait, my perpetrator isn't on there. Does that mean I'm not credible? So I have a short clip from Zach Heiner talking about the concept of credibility.
Only trained investigators can actually tell, you know, what is a credible case, what is not. And we know, you know, people who are more versed in sexual violence, people who work in it, people who study it, know that things like changes in story isn't indicative of a person lying. It's indicative of the way the brain processes trauma.
So Zach Heiner, executive director for the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Interesting, Katie, also this week comes at a time when we had this unprecedented Vatican summit, Pope Francis denouncing the abuse of minors, calling for an end to the Catholic Church's long history of covering up this scandal. So mirroring what is happening on a national, even a global level with this, Katie. Anything to mention before we say goodbye? Certainly a story that we are glad you will be following for us, continuing to cover in Western Iowa.
Yeah, I think the only thing worth mentioning is that there still are some questions up in the air about how far this problem goes to, and whether or not, you know, what sort of cases came since 1995, and why have these not been deemed credible? So I think that's something we still want to know.
Iowa Public Radio Western Iowa reporter Katie Pikus, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, a special election is coming up in a little more than 2 weeks for Senate District 30. That is a district that represents parts of Waterloo, Hudson, and Cedar Falls in eastern Iowa. It'll be on March 19th when Democrat Eric Giddens, he's a local school board member, will face Republican Walt Rogers, a former legislature, a House lawmaker. Thomas Nelson is with us. He writes for the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier. Hi, Thomas.
Hello.
Why is this, remind us before we get to the candidates, why is this special election needed?
Well, so Jeff Danielson, the former senator, held that seat up until Valentine's Day, actually, when he resigned both his seat and his from his job as a Cedar Falls firefighter, citing a controversial public safety program that they have going on there. And a week later, he announced that he was taking a position as a wind energy lobbyist and would be remaining in the Cedar Valley. And so since then, the Democrats and Republicans have started to mobilize. And this last weekend, they had their special conventions to nominate Giddens and Rogers to run for the seat.
What else can you tell us quickly about these two candidates? Giddens, a school board member. Rogers, a former House lawmaker.
Well, Eric Giddens is, you know, a big has really worked hard here for the Democrats in the Cedar Valley. Along with being a school board member, he also works as a program assistant at the University of Northern Iowa, and he's kind of focused on the environment and education. And he really campaigned hard for Dave Williams, the person who unseated Walt Rogers in 2018. Now, Walt Rogers ran in 2018 before losing to Dave Williams. Prior to that, he'd actually run for this Senate seat against Danielson in 2008 and lost by 22 votes. So this might end up being a comeback for him if he's able to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. And Walt Rogers, he served as a House lawmaker in that area?
Yes, he was actually the Iowa House District 30 is right in Iowa in the Iowa Senate District 60. It contains his old district along with Bob Kresick's district.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is really interesting because it comes right when we have a caucus season getting underway. So it's sort of seen as a test of the Democrats' strength in this. Next election cycle?
Absolutely. Actually, tomorrow, Elizabeth Warren is going to be kicking off Eric Giddens' campaign and holding a rally for him here in Waterloo. And the day after that, Congressman Eric Swalwell, another presidential hopeful, is going to be kicking off a rally for Eric Giddens here and also taking part in phone banks and calling people up.
Mm-hmm.
So and those are just the first two in this first weekend. I expect there's probably going to see more Democratic presidential hopefuls coming down here to Cedar Falls and Waterloo and Hudson to be part of this campaign. And as well, you know, you were seeing, you know, local legislators getting involved as well. I mean, Bob Kresick, who's been in this district for a while, has been sort of pushing here, and as well, we're seeing Roz Smith and all the other local legislators getting involved.
Of course, the Democrats would love dearly to hold on to this blue seat. The Republicans would love to pick it up, flip it over. The Republicans currently have 32 seats in the Iowa Senate. Now, that's close to the majority needed to control appointment confirmations without minority input. So this is something that the Republicans would dearly love. What can you tell us in terms of voter registration in this Senate district? Does that indicate possibly whether the Democrats or the Republicans have an edge here?
Democrats have the edge in voter registration in the Cedar Valley. Just flat out, they have the edge. Prior to Danielson leaving, the entire Cedar Valley, the metro area, was entirely controlled by Democrats. Jeff Danielson, who is a Democrat himself, after resigning, kind of rounded out the six-member Democratic delegation from this area. And Walt Rogers, for the longest time, was the one Republican. Now, and I think he's trying to become that one Republican again. And that's something Democrats in Black Hawk County are really cognizant of, and they're not taking that for granted.
Right, and of course, we had the blue wave, the so-called blue wave that flipped the U.S. House of Representatives, two of those seats in Iowa, in the 3rd District, Cindy Axne, but also there in the 1st District, Abby Finkenauer. But there was limited success with Iowa Democrats. Of course, they didn't flip either house of the Iowa legislature, and also the Republicans maintained their control by electing Kim Reynolds to the top executive position there. So quickly before we go, we have less than a minute here. I have to after hearing you, Thomas, I have to expect that there'll be a lot of door knocking, a frenzy of get out the votes efforts there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, right now, Walt Rogers is no stranger to that. I mean, he having just run in 2018, he was one of the few Iowa House seats that was flipped in that season. And I would imagine Eric Giddens is no slouch in that department either. He was one of the people who was out knocking for Dave Williams and really worked hard to put him in that office. So we're already seeing a lot of Republicans and Democrats getting ready to go out and canvass. The only problem is the weather, which has prevented them from getting out. The two canvass sessions ended up getting canceled during Sunday because of bad weather, and then again on Monday. So it's to be expected, but at the same time, it's not the greatest season for walking outside.
No kidding. Thomas Nelson, staff writer for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Thanks for joining us, Thomas.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk more about the weather. In fact, I'll talk with a teacher at an elementary school in Waterloo where the roof collapsed under the heavy weight of snow. We'll talk about it when we get back. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
So glad to have you along for this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Once upon a time, here in our state, it was debated whether basketball was healthy and appropriate for girls. In a few minutes, we'll go back to revisit that time. The Iowa State basketball girls basketball tournament is underway, and it's turning 100 years old. In just a few minutes, I'll talk with the assistant director of the Iowa State Girls High School Athletic Union. And before that, let's get back to the weather. We just heard in the news, no surprise there. We set a record in February for snowfall here in Iowa. I had to laugh when I saw this Des Moines Register article. Here's the headline: Iowa woman hates Iowa, wants you to buy her house. A profile photo on Wendy Lang's Facebook account says it all. There she is, spelled out in capital letters above a photo of her in a snowy scene. This has gone viral. She wants to sell her house, really. I guess this is for real, and buy a camper. Now, this photo has been shared over 25,000 times when I checked this morning. So far, the house has not been sold, as far as we know. can't blame her. I don't hate Iowa, that's for sure. But this winter has been something to get through. Repercussions from our brutal winter weather of a more serious nature. Last week, you heard this perhaps, a portion of a Waterloo Elementary School roof collapsed under the weight of snow piled on top of it. Thankfully, nobody was at the school at the time. Chris Byers is with us, a teacher at Lowell Elementary School in Waterloo, which is closed until August. She joins me now. Chris Byers, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben, for having me.
It was a snow day. Nobody was there, thankfully, right? Because there's 400 students at that elementary.
You are correct. It was another one of our snow days, and there's actually we have about 310 students, but it was a blessing that we were not at school that day.
So when you look at the damage, I did see some photos online. What rooms were impacted? Because this roof just went right down, didn't it?
It sure did. It's actually the picture that you've probably seen online or from the news sources is one of our fourth grade classrooms, and very few things were salvageable. It's my understanding that what was able to be salvaged from that room would fit in a milk crate. And then because of that, it sparked all of the sprinkler systems on that part of the school to go off in the fire alarms. So the room right below that was our music room, so everything in the music room was water damaged. And then there were a few other classrooms that had some minor water damage as well from the sprinkler system.
Thankfully, just a big mess. You've been to see it, I'm sure, right?
We have seen the building. I've seen it from the outside. I didn't want to actually go up and look in the room. It's just kind of a sad situation.
Right, but I mean, to look at it from afar even, you shudder to think what might have been.
Absolutely. You can see it actually from our playground. So when we weren't allowed back in, we've only been allowed to be back in the building for about 2 hours. So I did kind of walk by, and it was it kind of took my breath away to think what could have happened had we been in school that day.
Right. Okay. So what would tell us about the repairs? Well, tell us, first of all, where are you holding class now?
We have an amazing district administrative team that spent all day the next day looking at different options in and around Waterloo to see where we could be housed. And thankfully, Central Rivers Area Education Agency had vacated their former conference building and has enough space that all of our kids could all go to school together. So we are in the former Central Rivers AEA Conference Center. So it is right across the city boundary for Waterloo.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how much of a hassle is this for you and the other teachers to just transfer it?
Oh, boy. so Friday was the day we were allowed 2 hours to be in our classrooms, and we were told just to pack anything personal that we didn't want movers to move. And then the district had hired an amazing moving company. They specialize in moving and disasters and things like that. They came in and packed all of our essential school things up, delivered it over the weekend, even with our nasty weather. And fortunately or unfortunately, we had another snow day on Monday, so teachers could choose to come in on Monday and start setting up their new classroom space. And then we were given Tuesday as a school day to continue. So we had 2 days to set up an entire new classroom in space not really designed for classrooms. But our staff, with the help of a lot of community people, made it happen.
This will be something that will stand out a lifetime for the first graders that you teach and the other ones at Lowell Elementary School. What has been some of the notable reaction you've had from the kids you teach?
At first, there was, as they were coming in on Wednesday morning, there was a lot of confusion, obviously because they didn't know where their classrooms were, and there's no lockers like they're used to being able to put their things in, and where's the cafeteria, and where's the gym, and where are we going to have recess, all those normal kid reactions. But after that initial confusion, most of my students and what I'm hearing from a lot of the other teachers were just so relieved to be back at school and to see their friends and to see that all of their stuff is here, their tables and their school supplies and their teachers, that even though we're in a different building, lots of familiar faces and things were here ready to greet them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a year you needed this, not as if you would need it any year, but this has been a very disruptive year for school because of the weather. This adds to it. So how many snow days have you had up there?
We've had 9 as a district, and then we had 2 additional ones because of not being able to be in school and not having our new facility set up yet.
Mm-hmm. I understand, though, the community has just had a tremendous reaction in support of your elementary school, hasn't it?
Overwhelmingly, we even today, over a week later, are still having community organizations and people contacting us and bringing us things. We've had everything from an overabundance of school supplies to we put out a need because there's no shelving units here for teachers to put books and things on, and we put a call out for that, and within hours we had almost 20 sets of shelves delivered here. We've had different organizations provide lunch for our entire staff all week, so teachers didn't even worry about needing to bring a lunch to school. We've had snacks for kids because a lot of the kids that didn't normally ride a bus now have to have a bus ride at the end of the day. Mm. So we can give them a snack before they get on that bus. It's just been over. I mean, we've also had lots of monetary donations. So necessary supplies or things teachers weren't able to bring can be purchased. It's just been amazing what the Cedar Valley and beyond has done.
Okay. I mentioned at the outset that your Lowell Elementary School is closed until August because of this collapsed roof because of the heavy
yep.
weight of snow. What do you hear? What can you tell us about the process to repair it? I mean, I know structural engineers, contractors have been surveying the damage,
yep.
haven't they?
Yep. They right away had insurance people, engineers, and architects in to kind of assess the damage and see what needed to be done. And the last word I had gotten is that they're actually starting that renovation today. Today was the day they were going to start to remove a lot of the broken or damaged sections. They will have to take down that whole wall behind that fourth grade classroom in the music room and rebuild that, and then obviously put on a new roof and redo, you know, those classrooms completely, new carpet, new cabinets, new mm-hmm. walls, everything.
Mm-hmm. I know you didn't see it, but from afar, what do you understand as percentage-wise, how much of Lowell Elementary School is impacted? How much did it collapse on?
It really only collapsed on one classroom, which was fortunate. Out of about, I would say, 20-ish classrooms, I would say we have about 20 between classroom teachers and specialists and things. So that was the other really fortunate thing, is it was really contained to 2 classrooms that were affected, but they deemed that it really wasn't safe for any of the classrooms to be used until they get that wall reinforced and a new roof, which is why we then had to look for a new location for us.
Well, we can thank our lucky stars, can't we, Chris Byers, that nobody was at the school at the time. It was a snow day. Chris, thank
yes.
you for giving us a better picture. We wish you all the best for you and your first graders and all the other elementary kids there at Lowell Elementary School in Waterloo. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much, Ben, for contacting me. I'm really glad I got this opportunity to speak with you, and just, you know, I know there's too many people for me to name, but thank all the people and organizations and businesses that have stepped up and helped us out in our great time of need.
Okay, what a tremendous outpouring of support. Chris Byers of Lowell Elementary School, thank you so much. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, this weekend, Iowa high school girls are competing for state titles. That's at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. This comes as the state basketball tournament celebrates a 100th anniversary. It's the oldest tournament like this in the country, and it survived a heated debate in the 1920s here in Iowa. Jason Esslinger joins us now, assistant director of the Iowa State Girls High School Athletic Union. Jason, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you very much. It's nice to talk to you today.
You're right at the tournament, I understand.
Yeah, we got a game going on right now, a 2A semifinal. Central Decatur is playing Trainer, and yeah, we're right in the heart of it right now. We've got our finalists set up for class 5A and 3A and 4A, and then the 2As and the 1As will play this morning and this afternoon to find out who makes the finals there, and then tonight we have our 3A or 5A and 3A championships. So it's been a busy week.
Mm-hmm. I think you can watch us on IPTV, right?
That is correct. The state finals are on Iowa Public Television. You can stream it or watch it on television.
So you found a quiet place to talk to us for a few minutes.
I did.
What is the energy like today?
It's the energy all week is really outstanding. I mean, it really is a showcase of athletics in Iowa, especially our girls athletes. It's a culmination of a long season, obviously, with basketball, and we've seen some tremendous players. We've seen some tremendous teams, and the girls are really excited to be here. I mean, for a lot of the girls, and this is kind of our mission as a state association is to give, for many girls, I mean, obviously some go on to the next level, but for many of them, the state tournament is the culmination of their athletic careers. And we want to make this as special as possible for them. And we try to make sure everyone has a really good week and are treated extra special.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the history of this tournament. It was founded 100 years ago, about in 1920. Tell us, how was the tournament founded? I mean, this is unique. It was unique in the country, right?
It really was. The tournament basically kind of started as you might even want to call it a round robin tournament, but it was at Drake University. There were 24 teams invited. There were four rounds of play, and basically you had Correctionville and Nevada met in the first championship game, and they won. Correctionville won the first ever state championship 11-4. If you can believe, and that was typical for many of the scores in the early era of girls basketball. There wasn't a lot of scoring. But again, the game was much different. There was three courts, kind of a three court system where you had every time there was a basket, they'd throw it in the middle of the center circle, and then there would be a jump ball. And so the rules were very, very different at that time. But then for many years, the tournament went to different sites, Audubon, and went back to Des Moines, went to Iowa Falls, different area locations until we kind of found a permanent home in Des Moines mid-1930s before we used the Drake Field House, and the Drake Field House was our home for until 1955. Veterans Auditorium was our home, obviously, and then went from a basically double the size of our space to hold championships, went to a 15,000 seat arena, and we sold it out year after year after year. And Vets was a great home for us until 2005. In 2006 season, we moved to Wells Fargo Arena, and the tournament is really unique in the aspect of the following that it's had throughout the years. We have generations of Iowans that have basically grown up with the girls' state basketball tournament. I remember growing up the same thing. It was always appointment TV on championship nights, watching it at our house too. So it's a staple for many Iowans.
Jason Esslinger is with the Iowa State Girls High School Athletic Union. Let's go back to the 1920s because this is really an interesting part of the 100-year history of this Iowa State Girls Basketball tournament. When what? 1925, school administrators voting to discontinue sponsorship of girls basketball with concerns that it was unhealthy and inappropriate for girls?
That's right. Basically, the National Federation of High Schools, which is still our governing body as far as rules and things like that, but at that time, the overwhelming opinion was that it was not athletics was not a healthy lifestyle, I guess, for women. And they were afraid, school administrators and the National Federation were afraid that serious harm would come to women if they played athletics, a strenuous activity, and that it was bad for girls and women. And so the Iowa High School Athletic Association, who was a member school of the NFHS, I mean, when the NFHS voted to discontinue girls sports, they obviously as a member went along with that. At the time, this led to, because girls basketball, we've been playing state tournaments for 5 years, and it was a very popular option in Iowa. Obviously, there were a lot of superintendents. There was a meeting at a church in Des Moines, and a bunch of superintendents basically got together. In fact, the famous moment, I guess, was there was a superintendent from Mystic High School. His name is John W. Agins, and he made a speech and said, "Gentlemen, If you attempt to do away with girls basketball in Iowa, you'll be standing at the center of the track when the train runs over you. And from there, there were 25 rural school districts. They voted to form a separate organization, one that wasn't governed by the National Federation of High Schools. And that's how our organization, the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union, was formed. And that was, and basically we continued that basketball as kind of our primary sport until our only sport until the 1950s when we branched out to other activities, the late 50s, and sponsored other activities. But girls basketball remained healthy in Iowa for years and years and years. And it was where you had other states in the United, or other states in the country that did not have any athletics for girls at that time.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute or two left here. Tell us about the notable items commemorating in this 100th year anniversary tournament.
Well, one of the things we've done, we tried to find the oldest living Iowa girl, someone that had played in the basketball tournament long, long ago. We actually found a 104-year-old that'll be honored, along with many other Iowans that grew up playing the six-player game that we'll recognize them tomorrow at the state championship game. The other thing that'll be kind of interesting is, we're having at halftime of our 1A championship tomorrow, we're having a 6-on-6 game. Obviously, we've gone to 5-on-5 basketball now, but 6-on-6 is what so many Iowans grew up and loved, including myself, throughout the decades. And, you know, many of the girls today, I mean, their parents played 5-on-5, so there's a whole generation that really knows nothing about the six-player basketball game. So we have junior varsity squads from Dowling Catholic High School and Ankeny Centennial are going to be playing at halftime, and they're going to be coached by two legendary coaching staffs. Dick Rasmussen at Ankeny, who won many state titles, will be coaching the Centennial team, and Bob and Sharon Hansen, who have six state titles. They're going to be coaching the Dowling Catholic team. So we're going to kind of bring it back in a little short form at one of our halftimes. And we've been honoring, having little things all week long. The governor made a proclamation on Tuesday proclaiming this week Iowa Girls Basketball Week in Iowa. And so we've had a lot of fun things during the course of the week. And obviously we'll have some other activities such as our Hall of Fame inductions and some other awards that we give out. So it's been a full week.
Wow, sounds like excitement has been and continues to be. Through the weekend, the Iowa State Girls Basketball Tournament celebrating 100 years. Jason Esslinger, Assistant Director of the Iowa State Girls High School Athletic Union. Thanks for giving us some color here, a sense of it at present and it's in history. Jason, thanks.
Thank you. It's fun talking to you.
To finish up our News Buzz edition of River to River, let's go to Tony Daner, Studio One Tracks host in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
Wow. All sweaty, ready to go.
All right.
We need some music to groove into the weekend.
You always need some music, Ben. Today, it's Better Oblivion Community Center. This album came out about a month ago by now with kind of a cool viral marketing thing leading up to it. But this is a project between Phoebe Bridgers, who's kind of a rising star, and Connor Oberst. He's been at it for a long time. These two have been friends and musical collaborators for a few years now. They sound like they've been making music together for 20 years. This new album's really good, this self-titled album. And they played this song we're going to hear the night before, the day the album was announced and the day before the album was released on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. This is Better Oblivion Community Center with Dylan Thomas.
Better Oblivion Community Center. Tony, I think we have time to squeeze in another to help us groove into the weekend. What do you got for us?
Sure. The Tedeschi Trucks Band, Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks. They're not only musical partners, but they have been married for a while now. And they've got a new record called, Let me look up the name of this record. It's called Signs, and they were actually the subject of a nice story this morning on Morning Edition. I'm looking at it right now on NPR's website, so check that out if you get a chance. This new album is also the final recorded appearance of the band's longtime keyboard player, Kofi Burbridge, who passed away the day the album came out. So very sad, but we are glad to have this final recording with Kofi Burbridge. This is the Tedeschi Trucks Band, and I'm going to be there.
I want to say goodbye, Tony. Thanks for grooving us into the weekend.
Anytime, Ben. Thank you. Because I'm going to be just fine. It's all about you now. And we're running out of time.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Also help today from Lulu Dewey. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm with you, and you can live good.